All right, well, let's get started. First of all, welcome to the 2024 edition of the DMSE Masterclass. As you know, this is a monthly class for current DMSE students, faculty, and those interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, A.T. Still University. And this gives us the opportunity to hear from inspiring masters in the PA profession and or those in healthcare who have really made a difference. A few housekeeping issues. Please keep your microphones on mute. If you have any comments during the presentation, please make them in the chat section. And once we're finished, we'll open it up to questions and you can unmute yourself. But let me just take a minute or two to introduce our guest today. I've been looking forward to this, Mr. Rick Rohrs. Rick is a 1977 graduate of the Johns Hopkins PA program and has practiced internal medicine in a hospital setting for the last 45 years. Yep, that's not a typo, 45 years, transitioning from a clinical to an administrative role during that time. He's held various positions within Northwest Hospital and LifeBridge Health Provider Leadership. His current role is Assistant Vice President of Provider Operations, where he has been responsible for the administration of employed and contracted provider services such as hospitalists, anesthesia, PAs, emergency providers, hospice, and surgical assistants. He works in close collaboration with the president, the CMO, and the medical staff leadership to align provider and hospital goals. He also oversees the medical education department, as well as serving as community liaison for the magnet school partnerships with Baltimore City and County Public Schools. Rick has a long history of professional involvement, having served as president and board chair of the American Academy of PAs, the National Commission on the Certification of PAs, and the Maryland Academy of PAs. He was named Outstanding PA of the Year by the Maryland Academy in 1987 and by the AAP in 2000. Most recently, he served as president of the National PA Foundation and currently serves as the chair as the board on the board as chair-elect of the NCCPA Health Foundation. As part of the PA profession's celebration of their 50th anniversary, he was named one of 50 PAs making a difference by the NCCPA and received the first ever Distinguished Life Award from the Maryland Academy. In 2015, he was named a senior fellow in hospital medicine by the Society of Hospital Medicine. He was the second PA to have received this prestigious honor. In 2020, he was named Outstanding Alumnus of the Community College of Baltimore County. Rick has been instrumental in many PA regulatory and legislative efforts on both the local and national level. He has served as chair of the AAPA Government Affairs Committee, as well as chair and member of the MAPPA Legislative Committee. He has testified countless times on behalf of PA and healthcare legislation. Additionally, he co-founded the Maryland Educational Conference, Trends in Patient Management, and managed the program for over 25 years. He's also been a delegate or alternate to the AAPA House of Delegates on many occasions since the early 1980s, and has been a national thought leader on the PA profession and especially their role in hospital medicine. In the past 20 years, Rick has been involved in international workforce development, serving as the first chair of the AAPA International Affairs Committee, and then working as a consultant to many countries throughout the world. He's led delegations to the Netherlands, Taiwan, Great Britain, China, Canada, Cuba, and Brazil. He has also done humanitarian missions to Africa. Rick holds multiple faculty appointments, including George Washington University and Towson University. He chairs the Towson PA Program Advisory Committee and in the past chaired the Self-Study Committee for George Washington, where he was awarded the Outstanding Community Service Award in 2019. He has been actively involved as a lecturer and preceptor for PAs and medical students for over 40 years. And I could go on, but I really want to get to talking with Rick. So, Rick, welcome to our master class. Well, I think you're muted.
There you go. Too
There you
many
are.
buttons here. There we go.
Yeah,
Apologize. All right. Well, thanks so much, Randy. I really appreciate those kind words. It's an honor to be here. I hope we have more of a conversation, not a lecture, no
yes.
PowerPoint tonight. I'll give you a little trivia for the class. Randy and I share the same birthday, along with another famous or perhaps infamous person, depending on your viewpoint. So we'll sure somebody by the end of the first couple of questions will probably have that. We'll Google that and be able to point out who that might be.
That's funny. That's very infamous. Okay. We'll see if anybody picks it up by the end. So Rick, let's just start off. You tell us, many, many years ago, what brought you to this crazy profession called physician assistant?
It was kind of a somewhat circuitous path here to get to become a PA. I started out as a Baltimore City police officer. I then kind of transitioned to working in psychiatry, which isn't a big big change from being a police officer. Ended up in nursing school. I was did a year of nursing school, and I was introduced to the PA profession by another student, Tom Kilman, who was in my biochem class. And I had never heard of PAs. I didn't know what a PA was. And I wondered why this guy, who seemed very bright, very articulate fellow, would want to be a medical assistant. He had been a Green Beret in Vietnam and things like that. And he, we went to lunch and he kind of sold me on the concept. So I applied, fortunately got accepted, and was lucky enough to work with Tom on MAPA legislative efforts for several decades. He was huge, instrumental in us getting prescribing privileges in Maryland. He worked in pediatric oncology for many years. And so I always say, the reason I'm here is because he did a good sales job on getting me to join the PA profession and kind of transitioning from nursing at that time. Being a PA was a perfect choice. It's been a rewarding half century.
Wow, I had no clue that you started off as a police officer. We'll have to talk sometime. Very interesting, because I almost, well, I'll tell you, on the day that I got accepted to the PA program, I also got accepted to the Phoenix Police Academy, and I had to make a decision. So you know what decision was. So anyway, very interesting. Well, Rick, so you've practiced, gosh, in a hospital setting, internal medicine for over 4 decades. That's got in the same area. Tell us more about that experience and in the past and the ongoing experience of doing that as a PA.
It seems like it was yesterday, to be honest with you. It's hard to believe it's been in July I'll start my 48th year at the hospital. So it's
Wow.
I still remember it like it was yesterday. It was really amazing to be part of the growth of the profession and really in medicine in general. While you're in the moment, you don't realize the speed of how quickly things are moving. Just thinking of medical advancement. I talk to students, all the time and talk to them about physical exam and things like that. We had no CAT scans, no computers, no MRIs. There was what, one or two antibiotics you had, couple blood pressure medicines. We couldn't prescribe. I remember going to my first time I went to the medical executive committee at the hospital. It was to get for PAs to be able to write diet orders. So that gives you a sense of where we were and where we are now. And it's just been amazing to see the transition, not only in our profession, but alongside how medicine advanced. Some of you might remember the NCCPA used to have a 6-year cycle. It's 10 years now for recertification. And that was based on, I had used to have conversations with Dave Glazer, and some of this was based on data that suggested that the half-life of medical information was 6 years. That's why they came up with the 6-year cycle for PAs. Today, it's pretty much measured in days, weeks, definitely not in years anymore. And this is kind of where we need to think about things like AI. Is this where the interface of medicine and AI will need to occur? We need to be sure that it's complementary to providers, not a replacement for providers. I always tell provincial new employees that we hire you for personality, teamwork, lifelong learning skills, because what you learned in PA school, as difficult that as that might be, is going to be out of date in a short matter of time, a big chunk of it. Obviously, some of your anatomy and things like that isn't going to change, but how we treat patients, all parameters of medicine really are going to change over in a very short time after you graduate from school. Another area that I really saw advancement was PAs being in the leadership. When you think of it, like I said, we couldn't write diet orders. Now our critical care unit is run by PAs. We don't have a physician at night. We have a team of critical care PAs and NPs that basically are managing these patients, very complex patients, who I couldn't have conceived that we would be taking care of, 50 years ago. So kind of as our department grew, as our role grew, my kind of role evolved because I always look for the opportunity to say yes. It's one of my philosophies. Say yes. And I would go back and after a meeting and tell the staff, I said, look, guys, here's what we agreed to. And they would, you did what? And so sometimes we just had to figure out the how after the fact. But it helped advance and make the profession a lot more indispensable. And that's, I think, a big part of why we're able to grow, because we filled holes that were in the system by the flexibility that we have as a profession, and by really just being there and answering the questions and answering the needs.
Yeah, boy, and to be at the same place for almost 48 years is incredible. I can't even imagine the changes that you've seen over that period of time. And in addition to that, Rick, I can always remember I never went to a PA conference or an AAPA meeting or an NCCPA meeting that I didn't see you. And so, speaking of saying yes, in addition to your clinical practice, as far as you spent your entire career volunteering in many leadership roles with the AAPA, the NCCPA, even back in the day when we had some changes in the NCCPA, we could talk about that. Now the PA Foundation and then in the NCC Health Foundation. So why do you do that, Rick? Talk a little bit about advocacy for the profession, what it's done for you, and what it would do for other folks.
Well, my wife thinks it's an addiction, and thinks I probably should get some counseling. But my motto has always followed a quote by Ronald Reagan, where he said, "We can be masters of our own destiny, or we can be victims of fate." I obviously prefer the former. Maybe part of that's just a little being a little bit type A, wanting to be in control, not having things happened to me that I didn't have a chance to influence. And you remember our good colleague Ann Davis, she had a great quote as well. And she said, if you don't have a seat at the table, there's a good chance you're on the menu. That being said, I was tricked into getting involved. I never was involved as a PA student. I don't SAPA didn't exist at that point, I don't think, but I never really was involved with the Maryland Academy. I worked full time through a PA school. I didn't realize my wife was planning to have a baby. So I ended up, I worked all night and got up. When I got off of work in the morning, I went to my to PA school or clinical rotation, whatever year it was. Went home, slept for 3 hours, went back to work. So I never really had a chance to really get involved. And shortly after graduation, somebody said, hey, do you want to go to a party? So see somebody's new apartment or something like that. And I said, okay, sure, I could use a party. Sounds like a good idea. And I went there and I left a meeting being nominated to be president of the Maryland Academy. So I don't know how many beers I had that night or if anything, alcohol, anything to do with it. But nonetheless, I came out and that was kind of the start of my involvement. And really, what happened, it kind of got thrown into the fire right from the get-go. We came out, the Attorney General of Maryland had come out with a ruling basically saying that the enabling regulations that they were using for PAs didn't really enable us. And that they were going to put out a cease and desist order at that point. I can't remember how many PAs there were. My number at graduation was 167. So couple hundred PAs in Maryland at that time. So at 25 years old, I'm testifying before the legislature in Annapolis. I'm meeting with the governor. Things I never imagined I would be doing ever, much less, shortly after graduating. And I started to say, maybe I should have just stayed in nursing at that point. Nobody was challenging nurses, and but it was kind of a it was a really great learning experience. And to be honest, some of this is a little bit selfish on my part. My professional involvement really has been very symbiotic with my employment position. So what I learn in one, I can use to the other, and vice versa. So when I, learning how to write good letters, for a legislative committee and things like that, or how to write good letters within the institution, how to run a meeting, how to do an agenda. When I became, I had to step in to be treasurer of MAPPA because our treasurer got elected to go to medical school in the Air Force. So she had to leave in the middle of her term. And so I had to learn, learn how to do budgeting and, balance sheets and things like that. That helped me when I got the opportunity to do the budget for a department at the hospital. So being able to do one, and I always tell people that, every chance to get involved is a chance to learn something, to make yourself better and make yourself more valuable. And the whole value proposition is not only for the profession, but individually, it's what do you bring to the table? I can tell you it wasn't always easy. I give people advice, don't give up. I don't know if you remember, I ran for the AAPA board 4 times and lost 4 times. Mary Ettery beat me twice, I think by a total of 20 votes. All elections were close, but there's no prize for second place at that point. And I think they got tired of me running, so that's when they sent me off to the NCCPA for about 9 years. So there's so many opportunities to be involved that nobody really ever should feel like they're left out. So like I said, to me, it's something I love, and it's something that's helped me grow as a professional.
Yeah, and Rick, I think for me it's also been sort of selfish on my part because over the years have an opportunity to go to conferences and rub shoulders with folks like yourself and many others and learn things and not only make friends and colleagues. Well, you'll remember when Jim Colley and I were first put on the commission, you and Marshall Sinback and Ed, I forgot his last name, took us out to dinner. To a really wonderful place that overlooked the Statue of Liberty. Do you remember that?
Yeah, absolutely.
It was
We won't go on about the rest of that night, though.
no, but it was a wonderful evening to sort of sit back and learn about the commission at the time because we were coming in there. So not only do you learn a lot, but then you make lifetime friends. And so yeah, that's great. Let's sort of, since we're talking about the profession a little bit, let's move into some professional issues to see what your thoughts are. As you know, in 2017, the House of Delegates approved optimal team performance, OTP, or optimum team practice, I'm sorry. What are your thoughts on this and where it's going, and is it enough?
I was, I remember the conversation in the House when OTP first came up. Very supportive of the element. Most of the elements was one I'll get to. I don't really agree with, but it's really, I think right now it's essentially kind of it's almost like an affirmation of the status quo in many practice settings. PAs practice autonomously. Most clinical decisions they make are independent, but there's a certain degree of physician oversight, and that varies. Is it paper oversight? Is it actual physical oversight? Is it, how often are you bouncing things off? Or is it just a resource that's there when you need it type of thing? More and more often that physician relationship is tangential at best. There's a name on a piece of paper, and especially in a hospital setting where we run into a situation where the people that it's another hospital employee supervising another hospital employee. It's not like you're working for Dr. Jones and Dr. Jones is getting some tangible benefit of your employment. It's basically I'm in charge of the department. You're in the department. I'm here. You're here. So, it's just a pecking order. I'm not 100% sure that we need our own boards. We practice medicine, and we should be under the board that oversees medicine. Now, of course, this assumes that you have a fair board, that they're going to treat PAs and physicians equally, and that we have appropriate representation, at least proportionate to our numbers on that board. So we don't practice PAing. I hear people say, well, the nurses have their nursing board. Well, they practice nursing, and the podiatrists have their, well, they practice podiatry. We practice, we say, and we've taken great efforts to change the definition of what we do to say we practice medicine. But we don't want to be under the medical board. I didn't see that that connection. I know there are some states that have individual boards have for PAs and that function very well. But we're a profession. I mean, you could argue, some states still have DO and MD boards. So, but most of the states have combined those together, and because they've realized they all do the same thing, and with respect to protecting the public, ensuring high quality, and weeding out the ones that need to be or educated or remediated, whatever the case might be, when there are issues, I think we belong under that board. So that's one of the areas where I kind of disagree a little bit with the kind of boilerplate type of OTP model. We just went through a really difficult battle in Maryland with our Modernization Act. With the last minute, we have all this support all along, and then at the 11th hour, the Medical Society, in Maryland, the Medical Society is called the Medical and Chirurgical Faculty. It's the oldest medical society in the country. They were founded in like 1700. A lot of their thinking is still in the 1700s. They throw in poison pills at the last minute, and then you have to decide, do we try to get something, or do we just say bite it, grit it and just say no, no way. We want what we want, and we want full OTP. So we did get some things in it, but the concept of PAs not being a subset of the physician is what's difficult to explain to the legislators, especially when your name is physician assistant, and especially when organized medicine's lobbying against it. It's more important to eliminate, I think, the troublesome administrative barriers, and that's what we really did. We broke down, we got rid of a lot of hoops that PA had just like filing delegation agreements with the board. We can keep them on site now. So things that made PAs maybe more cumbersome to hire than a nurse practitioner or another APP, we worked to get rid of those. We still know that we have this big 400-pound gorilla in the room where we have to say, listen, we're not a subset of a physician. We're PAs, we practice, we have our own set of skills and ability, and we should be able to practice under, with that should be determining what I can do, what I can't do, not what Dr. Jones can and can't do. Another area is reimbursement. We need to ensure full credentialing by all payers because, to be honest, we're not Europe or Canada where we have an all-payer system, and it doesn't matter what initials behind your name, it's the task is being done. Here we constantly, I still get people calling me, well, how come CareFirst won't credential us? Blue Cross, why, how do you get reimbursed? What do you got to do all these workarounds and incident two and things like that, which then really don't give us the full credit for what we deliver as part of healthcare. So I think that's one of the big things, but none of this is going to get fixed if we can't address what really the apathy of our profession. And I hate to say that to a group of people that are clearly not apathetic that are on this call because these are leaders in the profession. But there are many great leaders, but far too many bystanders. And our membership is going in the wrong direction. I mean, I argue this with the AAPA all the time. The absolute number of people that are members might be increasing, but it should be increasing because we have, 12 to 15,000 new people joining the profession every year, and only maybe in a much smaller number leaving the profession on the back end. Eventually that will get equilibrium, but for right now, it's still pretty much skewed towards the front end of new people coming in. And we're just not getting as many of those people as we need to get to ensure a safe and secure future for the profession. So that's one of the things that's always on my to-do list, and I hope it's on the to-do list of everybody, is kind of try to break down those barriers and those walls for folks to get involved and help us move the needle and make OTP and even other things like the compact and things of that nature, make them reality.
Yeah, well said. And you brought this up a few minutes ago, and since we'll jump right into that, what's your take on the title change to physician associate? Obviously approved by the House and then ratified by the AAPA, and if I remember correctly, there's only one state, I think it's Oregon, that just recently changed to physician associate. We've had a few organizations change their name, a few state chapters. Michigan just changed their title. So what's your thought on that whole deal?
Yeah, it's interesting because I sit on the National Uniform Claim Committee, which is an AMA committee, and Michael Poe and I were just having a conversation. We oversee the taxonomy code, and we're kind of in a area now that Oregon has made that change about, do we now try to get physician associate, get a taxonomy code for that, and make sure that PA, because we have physician assistant on there. Do we get physician associate? The risk is one, as I said, it's a AMA, supports this committee. My concern is, do we have enough critical mass with one state to really do this, or should we wait until there's some more momentum? Because the last thing I want to do is go to a meeting and propose this at the AMA. And if you think I'm a little hoarse, it's because I'm just getting over COVID that I caught at the AMA last week at a meeting. So if you're going to, how ironic that if you're going to catch COVID, you catch it at the American Medical Association. But I'm probably in the minority. I voted for it in the House because I don't, it's one of the things where maybe anything's better than assistant. But I've never really liked to change to associate. I think the only real benefit, other than getting rid of assistant, is the continued use of the PA acronym. Other than that, it still ties us to physicians. I think it's just as confusing to the public. I mean, I don't think they're going to know what a physician associate. I mean, the nuance of that change, it makes a lot of sense to you, to us. Oh, I'm not an assistant. I'm associate to the doctor, but I don't know that they're going to really grasp that. I don't think the patients, most of us introduce ourselves as PA anyway. So I think the docs will continue to fight it because they're going to say, you're not my associate. My partner is my associate. Other physicians are my associates. Some won't, but there's some, we've already heard it. We heard the rhetoric that came out when we passed it from the AMA and other organized medicine. I'm just not sure it's worth the, I don't know how many millions of dollars that we spent and how many millions more we're going to spend to change it. I would have preferred the term medical practitioner or MP, not MCP, which was the other, if you remember from the consultant report, they suggested medical care practitioner. And I'm not sure if it's because the lead person on the consulting team was British and she didn't want MP because it might get confused with member of parliament, or I don't think that would be quite an issue, but nonetheless, they said it would be confusing. I think the docs would have had less opposition to medical practitioner, and I think it would have made the contrast between us and NPs much more apparent and emphasized our education in the medical model. I mean, if you had a choice in APPs, would you see a nursing trained NP or a medically trained MP? I think it would have been really, it would have probably moved us much closer to being aligned with physicians than maybe we are now as the physician's assistant. So that's my take on it. I'm certainly going to support the physician associate. And I know we can't go back now. It's just it. If I was king, I would have done it differently.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Let's go on to another controversial topic, certainly in the last few years. As you know, 309 PA programs out there now, all of them, master's programs. You remember back 15, 20 years ago when we converted, from bachelor's degrees to masters and what we had to go through with that. Now there's some talk about that our PA programs are moving to an entry-level doctorate degree. I'm not talking about the post-professional doctor of medical science or doctor of health science programs, but the talk and of course PAEA has taken a stand on this issue already last year, saying that they're going to stick with masters, but they will not stand in the way of PAs moving into the doctorate level. So, question on entry-level doctorate degree, has the train left the station? Is it going to happen, or what do you think?
I was part of the PAEA summit, and I
Yep.
actually was quite surprised that the outcome was not stronger to support kind of the eventual transition to the doctorate. I mean, I remember the number of votes were taken there, and straw votes and things like that. I mean, obviously it was eventually left to the membership of PAEA to the programs individually, but I was surprised. I knew it wasn't going to be, let's do it tomorrow, but I thought it would eventually, they would have leaned towards that in their final decision. One of the things I did there was I did a lot of number crunching on the, I'm an administrator, so that's what I do, on the actual cost to transition the PA, not just the cost of an individual PA. Here's what's going to cost in PA school now because it's a doctorate, so you're going to pay an extra $5,000 in tuition or whatever. But to employers, to educators, to the healthcare system at large, and it was actually in the billions, and that's billions with a B, dollars. When you consider all these factors, there's a lot of loss of productivity. By the time it would have gone into effect, you'd have 250,000 plus PAs. We remember when we went to the master's program. Well, first, when we went to the bachelor's program, you remember the
Yeah.
Nebraska. Jesse made a ton of money for Nebraska with a group of PAs that had certificates or AA degrees that had to get their bachelor's degree. The same thing happened when we went from bachelor's to master's. There was a catch-up for the existing PAs because nobody wants to be the one that doesn't have it. And so even if you said, okay, 250,000 PAs, only 20% of them are going to end up getting that, having feeling the need, especially it'll be people earlier in their career. I graduated 2 years ago, and now the doctorate is the standard coming out of, I can't practice for another 40 years not having a doctorate, so I've got to go back and get a doctorate. So those people have to go back and get, to a program like yours or another program, and spend more than a few dollars to get to keep up with the Joneses. So although when you put all those costs together, it's pretty significant for the system, for individuals, and but the aggregate cost is pretty high. That's not to suggest we shouldn't do it, but I think we just need to be aware of what the total cost is and what the true cost is. I think the doctorate is inevitable, just due to pressure from the healthcare system. There's degree creep, is everywhere in healthcare. We won't be immune. I sit on the Dean's Advisory Committee at Towson. The PT program has gone to doctorate. The OT program has gone to doctorate. All of this in the last 5 years. The PA program is in that same school. I'm not sure why eventually that same pressure wouldn't happen to the PA program. Now, one thing I would love is for us to be a little more creative than just simply, oh, let's just tackle on a couple, another semester or whatever we do, but really look and go back from the beginning and say, could we consider things like a 3-3 model? There are 3 years of undergraduate, 3 years of PA school, because, or even a 6-year program similar to what pharmacy does, or even the British model where they train physicians in 6 years. So I think there are different ways to get to the doctorate without just doing bachelor's degree, and now we're going to change a master's program to a doctorate program. So I hope when it does happen that we put some creativity to it, and try to think outside the box, and our whole profession was based on that concept. And I hope we don't follow what everybody else has done just because that's the way it has to be done. So.
Yeah, wow. Well said. And since it's going to be somewhere down the road, and I would say, 10, maybe 15, maybe longer before, the snowball starts occurring for entry level. So in the meantime, the post-professional programs, are going to be out there to help train PAs who want to get that doctorate. And for instance, right now, and it changes every week, there are 26 DMSC programs in the country. And when we started at A.T. Still, we were the third, after Tennessee and then Lynchburg and then us and then Butler and then Utah. But anyway, when we ask our students and we ask our graduates, why do you want to get a doctorate? This won't surprise you. Number one is they've been in practice for a while and they want to move into education. Makes all kinds of sense, particularly when we have 309 programs and we don't have enough faculty out there to teach. Number two, and this won't surprise you as well, they want to have that ticket, if they will, to be in the C-suites or be in some sort of a leadership role, whether it's in the military or public health service or Mayo Clinic or Cleveland Clinic, those kind of things. And so that ticket, whether we like it or not, helps them move into that. And thirdly, they would like to have parity with the nurse practitioners, whatever that means, parity, because some of the things you talked about with legislation, needed because of the administrative barriers for PAs to actually get into practice. So a lot of stuff going on in the next 10 or 15, 20 years as
Yeah,
it relates to the doctoral. Yeah, go ahead.
it's really funny because in nursing you almost see a little bit of the opposite where in they have the DMP programs are out there for the clinicians, but the number of administrative nurses that are going back and getting a DMP versus going and getting a degree like yours would be, which would be, more focused into the role. They're going back and getting a clinical DNP with no intention to practice clinically. It's the easier doctorate for them to get. Three out of the five nursing executives at our hospital, we have multiple hospitals in our system, have all gone back and got their DNPs to get their doctorate. Because it's they can go out, do an 8-month online DNP program. It's funny, the chief nursing officer at one of the hospitals asking if they could do their clinical rotation with the PAs. It's just, why? You're not you, do you, are you planning to come back to be a clinical nurse? No, I got to do this to get the DNP. And the DNP is almost like it's the easiest NP doctorate or nursing doctorate to get. So whereas for us, we've got our PAs that are clinically practicing are going outside and getting, more applicable doctorate degrees to advance their career in administration. The DNP isn't going to teach these nursing executives better ways to practice in their chosen role and make them good clinicians. They might understand, medicine a little bit better, but it's interesting that they're doing almost the opposite of what we're doing here. So, and I'm surprising that you said it's 26 programs because I was just reading through the resolutions today, and there's a resolution obviously to with regard to the name of the program, of the doctoral degree. And they mentioned, I think only I think there was only 22 at that point. So whenever they wrote that, within a few months, so it shows you something about the growth if we're watching it in real time actually kind of move the needle.
Yeah, and in fact, we just created a consortium of DMSC programs, and I'm chairing that consortia. And we become a special interest group for PAEA, and in fact, we're meeting again, I think, next week. So what's really neat about that is 26 DMSC programs, all who are competitors. We get together, we talk about what's important for the profession. So I think it's a good deal. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah,
So,
well,
okay.
that worked for the postgraduate residency programs to some degree, where they kind of formed a group together. Kind of went by the way, excuse me, the wayside a bit, but.
Well, so, and I'm going to try to land this airplane pretty soon, but let's talk about another really important thing, and that is PA Professions Development internationally. You know, we all know about the UK and the Netherlands and certainly what's going up north in Canada, but it's happening all over the world, and you've been involved in that. Talk to us a little bit about that. Hope you're on mute. There you go.
Getting used to the new laptop here. So it's been an amazing development over the years, the 20 years, and watching the continued growth. I just did a thing for the History Society, to talk about it and give them some of the background statement. And I was cleaning up here, and I sent them three huge boxes of stuff that I had from different international trips and things that we had gotten from, gifts from different countries when we went and visited, a lot of the background paperwork and things like that. It's really interesting to see how the concept had developed differently, but kind of the same in across the world. We've always said, and my philosophy and what we when we started the International Affairs Committee was, we don't really care what you call yourselves. We're basically talking about people that are practicing medicine that aren't physicians. And, in South Africa, they're community health workers. They have different names in different countries. In England, ironically, they're physician associates. So it's they've got a lot of other issues in Great Britain, but but they're they've got the right name at least to start with. And I think the Netherlands is probably one of the best cases where we I went over there first in I think 2004 or so, and following the work that Ken Harbert had started. Ken was kind of the groundbreaker over there, and met with them. I went over and worked with Utrecht University, and we basically did a dog and pony show. Went around the country, met with the medical society, the hospital society, all the different big institutions in the country, educational institutions, the Ministry of Health, and we were able to answer a lot of questions. And basically, and I've always wanted to say, you don't have to do things the way we do them in America. We do things a certain way here. It fits. Again, even within our own country, PAs are utilized completely different in a variety of settings. We're great at being molding and fitting into a niche as it exists and filling a need. And it may differ from state to state, and even within a state, from hospital to hospital. And so all we want to do is tell you our story, tell you what we did, and hopefully it doesn't take you 50 years to get to where it took us. And that was the goal, to maybe give you a little bit of a running start towards having a successful profession. I got to give the commencement address back in 2006, I go maybe five, at the first graduation class at Utrecht in the Netherlands. And I went back for the 15th anniversary, and they have independent practice. They can do minor surgery, and they can do endoscopies, full prescribing, and there's 2,000 plus PAs there in a matter of 15 years. That's the big true success story. Obviously, Ireland, Great Britain have it, South Africa. A good class friend of mine, a classmate of mine from Hopkins, started the program in Liberia many years ago, and unfortunately lost a lot of his students during the Ebola. One of the health professions that was hardest hit was the PA profession in Liberia during the Ebola outbreak a few years back. And a number of our colleagues lost their lives taking care of patients. Ghana, it's funny, I was just reading about Ghana the other day. It's a country I did a medical mission there, and I was technically the first PA in Ghana. The PAs went on strike because they were getting pushback from organized medicine. So it's funny, they were on strike for a number of months until they got the docs to kind of back off. So it was an interesting to see that the different dynamic. When we went to China told us they had 300,000 PAs. But basically, they were talking about, and we're not talking about the barefoot doctors. We're talking about is basically folks that go through medical school but don't go into a residency. So they go and then practice out in the rural communities, underserved areas, and things like that. So they just elected not to further. I don't know whether they elected not to or whether it was just a grade-based system where they have so many people in medical school that they, if you don't hit a certain threshold, you don't go to a residency. I'm not sure how it works, but it was just an amazing experience. Many of the countries in Europe have PA. Germany, we met with, when we were over in the Netherlands, we met with the Germans. They have PAs now. India's had PAs for years in surgery, cardiovascular surgery. So if you pick up enough rocks, you're going to find out there's probably PAs in just about everywhere. Because, like I said, if you take the generic definition of a PA, as someone practicing medicine that's not a physician, there's probably a lot of folks around the world that are doing similar tasks to what we're doing to improve the health in their respective communities.
Yeah, wow. And there's still a lot more to do. Thank you. Well, I'm going to try to wrap this up today, Rick, but before we end this thing, what would be your advice to our DMSE students and our graduates, about the future of the PA profession?
I think stay involved with your state academies. One thing I've always been proud of, even when I was AAPA president and CCPA president, I was still actively involved with the Maryland Academy, because all politics are local, and they need, and I think it's a chance for you to mentor the next generation of leader. We need to be creative. Our profession in itself is a creation of Dr. Stead and others, Dr. Silver and other folks, and Dr. Estes. But look for opportunities to embed ourselves in the system and not just be PA centric. And I think you mentioned it earlier. We need to see the big picture. We're training people, your program and the other 25 programs that are out there are training people to do more than just be clinically practicing PAs. That's not to say that's a bad thing, but and we certainly need great clinical practicing PAs. But we need people to take those seats at that table that I mentioned earlier when they're available. If we don't, somebody else will. Things like productivity, adaptability to technology with AI and everything, cost benefit, these are going to dictate the successful profession. And what's probably going to be a pretty crowded future down the road. I think programs need to be cognizant of what the workforce needs are going to be. You mentioned 300 plus programs, 40 more, I think, are still in the pipeline. The pendulum always swings back at some point, and we may be seeing a crowded provider market. I mean, there are so many variables. Jim Cawley and I have this conversation all the time about how to predict when that might occur. When do we get to equilibrium with supply and demand of PAs and other health practitioners? It's very difficult to predict when that might happen, if it ever happens, because who knows what healthcare might be, but chances are we're going to get to that point. So I think avoiding specialty designations gives us a leg up on other professions as needs change. Because we're not pigeonholed to be in this particular aspect of medicine. What if we cure cancer and heart disease? What happens to all the oncologists and cardiologists? But now we're faced with more super infections and pandemics, and we don't have enough infectious disease folks or public health folks. Will primary care just default to artificial intelligence? I mean, it's some computer works 24/7 in the urgent care center. It can't suture a wound, but it can pretty much diagnose and prescribe just about anything else. Nobody wants to be the buggy whip manufacturer in the 21st century. So I think it's we need to embrace diversity. I think I'd say if I'm a young PA, learn another language. Pick one, but there's a good chance that you're going to have an opportunity to open some doors if you can speak another language. Understand and healthcare disparities. We have a just had a conversation at the NCCPA. when I was AAPA at president in 2006, my theme for that year was healthcare disparities. It's almost 20 years ago. It hasn't gotten any better. It's probably, if anything, healthcare disparities could be even worse than they were 20 years ago. So we have the ability to do that and help our patients and make sure we look at our patients for who they are, where they come from, what resources they have. The world that we grew up in, it's not going to be the same one over the next half century. So maybe some of the folks in this room that are closer to our age, it may not be as much of an issue because we're probably close to the end of our career. But if you're just starting out as a PA and you're looking at probably a 40-year, maybe even longer career, be flexible. And remember, when the opportunity presents itself, just say yes.
That's excellent. Well, I'm gonna open it up to some questions for Rick. So you guys be thinking of some questions. I'm gonna start with the first one. With all the work that you're doing, and the multiple irons you have in the fire, Rick, what do you do for fun?
Well, I do play golf with Professor Cawley from time to time. His creative scoring helps my game a lot. He has lots of rules about diameter and trees and things like that. So, if I can continue playing with them, I see the senior tour in my future. But played soccer for a while, but the knees told me I had to quit. So mainly traveling a lot. Spent a month in Tuscany in the south of France last year, and it was so incredibly relaxing. If I win a lottery, that's where you'll find me, over there with some other PA colleagues that are over there. We're going to Croatia in September, and then Hawaii in February. So kind of got the dance card getting filled up.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, let's open it up. Who has a question for Rick? No, nobody has their video on, but if you have a question, why don't you just unmute yourself, and if you want to show yourself on the video open too. Is not like a real class when you can point at somebody and say, "Hey."
Hi, Rick.
Hi.
Hi, my name is Anton. I'm the first year in the DMS program. You talk about the AI in the healthcare, and I'm so really interesting about the AI topic, but how do you think the AI can change the healthcare in the future? And thank you so much for the presentation. It's really good.
Thank you, and congratulations on being in the program, and wish you the best. AI is a double-edged sword. I put my administrative hat on, and I say, geez, if AI could do the same as a PA, and they work 24/7, no benefits, they don't call out sick, they don't complain, they show up at the staff meeting. But on the other hand, how do you teach a computer empathy? How do you teach it to read behind the lines? I mean, AI deals a lot with facts, not with nuance. And so much when we take care of a patient is that subtle nuance. Knowing, are you getting the whole story? I mean, they could fill out a questionnaire, plug it into the machine. The machine will say, oh, based on this, here, take this antibiotic. But are they going to see that this is an abuse situation, elder abuse situation, or domestic abuse situation? Are they going to pick up on all those opportunities for enhancing a patient care visit? So I think if we use AI as something that can be an adjunct, kind of like think of it as a really enhanced version of some of the clinical tools that we use now. When we pick up our telephone and that's where we get all of our information at. That's our little Bible, our Harrison's textbook of medicine we keep in our pocket. But there, one thing, I'll do a little commercial advertisement for anybody that's going to be at the AAPA conference. I just saw the announcement today that the second keynote speaker is going to be a very renowned expert on AI, and that's going to be the focus of that presentation. So if you don't get a chance to attend, hopefully they'll record that and be able to get that out to folks. But it's going to be really interesting to see how it does. I mean, I've heard somebody talking about AI and oncology, that there's 10,000 papers come out every day around the world on different cocktails for chemotherapy and things like that. Most providers can read a handful of those. Maybe they'll read a meta-analysis or something like that. The AI read every one last night, and took every one of those recommendations into their decision-making process. So that's a little, that's a little scary to think that we can't keep up with machine learning. But I think what we need to do is make sure that we leverage it to the best of our patients' needs and to our abilities.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right. Anybody else have a question or a comment?
Well, I never can be silent when Nigger Rick's around.
Yeah.
How are you? I was waiting.
How are you? And thank you very much. I think, just a couple of comments. I really appreciate a lot of your perspectives. We share a lot of those things about title change and OTP and work, independent boards and that sort of stuff. One of the things when you talk about that too is apathy of the profession. And I guess the thing that I think the message should be to PAs who don't volunteer to promote the profession locally or administratively or in their organizations. What's the best way to address that? When you hear that them say, well, that organization doesn't represent my interest, or how do you address that? How can we get all these PAs involved? Now that I'm a faculty member of the DMSC program, and Randy's given me the privilege of teaching the course in healthcare policy. And it's really interesting to learn how many PAs have never been involved and really are so unaware of the importance of just knowing basic things about the profession and basic things just to sort of get the doors open. What's the message? How can we get to them?
If I had that answer, I'd be going around every state academy and making a lot of money as a consultant. I've got a niece who's a PA who was vice president of SAPA, ran for SAPA president, but got out and was a little involved in Maryland. Always was a member, so always joined, paid her dues at AAPA and that, but got married, got babies, and got life. And life got in the way. And it's just one of those things which says, when the kids are grown, I'll come back. That's one example and maybe an extreme example. But it's the why is always the hardest thing to come up with, because everybody's why is a little bit different. Because when I talk about some of the changes in the Maryland law, they say, well, it doesn't bother me. It doesn't affect me. In fact, when we got PAs be able to sign death certificates, we got yelled at because people said, I won't do that. That means I got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Right now, the resident has to do it or the doctor has to do it. Now I got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, go down and fill out a death certificate on somebody I never saw before. So what we saw is breaking down a barrier they saw as a task that was adding to their plate. We all talk about, everybody's fat and happy and, and content. They're making their $130,000 a year and, they're working, they have their pick of jobs, that they can do. They don't have the motivation, and we need to, they need to understand that why. They need to understand that PAs, I mean, and I didn't bring it up on this, but the whole assistant physician movement that's going now and happening in a number of states. I know Arizona, you're getting hit with it, with the folks transferring from Puerto Rico, but there's a bill in Florida. There was a bill in Maryland. There are hundreds of thousands of potential assistant physicians around the world. that could easily come to the United States, where, I mean, they're not making $130,000 as a physician in their country. They could just easily come to the United States if that door is opened. And then suddenly there's competition for jobs. Well, who is the group that's going to be out there? When they wanted to be PAs, and not assistant physician, we were able to mobilize the PAs in Maryland very, very strongly back, 20 years ago, and we defeated the bill five times. But you don't get those causes. They're much more subtle. It's not like prescribing. When we all wanted prescribing, it was easy to get everybody on the bandwagon. But now it's some of it is generational, and I'm not going to, I won't be the old guy, that's, preaching to the younger kids, but we have to learn how to reach different generations on their terms and stop thinking that they're going to have the same understanding of why they should belong and how they should belong and what they should contribute because we did. It's a completely different environment now. And I think we need to make sure that we're strong generational leaders. I think that's important because that's how you start communicating. And if you can't communicate, it doesn't matter what you're trying to sell. And then you need to really build the case for the why. What's in it for them individually now, and what's in it individually? I try to tell them it's insurance. You got a car that, your car is worth $100,000 or $50,000, and you pay insurance on it. You got a home house that's worth $400,000, and you pay $2,000 a year insurance on it. Well, you have a career that's worth millions of dollars. Your career at 130,000 times 40 is a lot of money. And joining your state academy, joining the AAPA is an insurance payment. And if you were, if, you know, and that's resonated with some folks, and they never thought about it that way. Your state organization is ensuring you have a job for the rest of that career, because last thing you want to find out after investing 20 years in it, that suddenly, geez, you're being replaced by that computer, being replaced by that assistant physician from another country, or just being replaced because there's too damn many health providers out there. So that's a long-winded way to answer your question.
I thought it was a great answer. I'm gonna take this recording, and it's gonna be part of our class, Randy.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Anybody
Thanks.
else have a question? All right. Well, I realize it's Monday night and certainly late for folks, on the East Coast. But once again, Rick, thank you for your time participating in our master class. And thanks all of you for joining us today. Rick, any last comments before I close this off?
No, I just, I, again, it's an honor to have the opportunity to talk to your class. I appreciate the invitation. Wish you all the very best in your success. And if don't hesitate, Randy's got my email. If there's anything I can do or anything you want to follow up offline, just reach out to me personally and I'll be happy to have a conversation.
Great, thank you. All right. Well, so for the rest of you, please join us in May for our next master class. More information will follow probably in the next week. So, until then, we'll see you all down the road. Have a great evening.
Good night.
All right. Thanks, Rick.